Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander. Once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to the Socialist Insight. And today we have Alan Mackey. He's joining the program once again. He joins the program every other week. We discuss a lot of interesting topics, and Alan is always, from time to time, talking about baiting and switching. And we're going to discuss a little bit about what baiting and switching is all about from a consumer point of view. But for the most part, we're going to talk about baiting and switching that occurs on a regular basis in U.S. and state politics. And Alan, once again, thanks again for joining the program today.
Well, thanks for having me again, Stuart.
Alan, you talk about baiting and switching all the time, and I'm in the car business, and people understand what baiting and switching is when it comes to trying to buy a car. They walk on the lot, they see an ad in the paper. Here's a car that the regular price on it is $19,795. They see an ad in the paper that the car is being sold for $14,895, and it's almost a $5,000 swing. Obviously, right. It's eye-popping when they see it in the ad. They rush to the dealership real quick, and they finally find the car. But all of a sudden, when they get in the booth and they're working with the salesperson starts out with this ridiculous figure that it is nowhere nearly remote to the price that they had seen in the ad. First thing the customer says, "This is baiting and switching."
Right.
So this happens every day. And a lot of times people, what they don't see, Alan, is they don't see the fine print that at the store they start playing the game where they say, well, that price, the price that we're giving you, we have included a warranty. The price that we are giving you, we're putting some additional wheels and tires on them. And people say, just give me the price on the car. Just give me the price that you have in the ad. And the game playing may go on for like 3 or 4 hours, but basically it was baiting and switching that got them in the door, and now they got to play a game. And sometimes what happened is they wear the customer down, and the customer still pays more than his fair share of what he had bargained for. But, Alan, I want you to explain, what is baiting and switching? Because, you know, obviously that's what I see, because I see it in the industry that I work in, which is very unfair to consumers, but it happens. But what is baiting and switching from your perspective and also in politics?
Well, it's just what you explained, Stuart. And when it comes to politics, the Democrats are really good at this. They've learned it very well over the last 50 or 60 years. And an example would be Obama. When he was seeking the nomination, he went all across the country. And a lot of people say they don't believe this, but if anybody doubts what I have to say, I can prove it with videos of Obama himself talking. But he went all across the country saying that he was for single-payer universal health care. He talked about he wanted the same kind of health care that they have in Canada. Now,
correct.
Once he got elected, it was a totally different story. The bait was single-payer. He got everybody worked up that he was going to be supporting single-payer universal health care if he got the nomination and was elected president. Well, he gets the nomination, and then he started backing away from single-payer. But once it was even worse once he was elected. When he was elected, he came up with this whole Obamacare scam, and that's all that is, a scheme and a scam to make the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies even richer. And he forgot about single-payer universal health care. So we had the bait. That was single-payer universal health care. That was the bait to get the votes. The switch came with Obamacare, which has nothing in common at all with single-payer universal health care. It's not going to get as close to single-payer health care. it's moving us in the opposite direction. That was the switch.
Right.
And we get the same thing with the minimum wage. Here in Minnesota, you know, and Dayton used the same example, but I use it because I live here in Minnesota, of Governor Dayton. He came to me and wanted my support when he was trying to get the nomination. We agreed on 3 points. One of those points was that he was going to be for a living, non-poverty minimum wage. He even held a press conference a couple days after he and I had this discussion, and he came out in support of a living, a minimum wage that was a non-poverty wage. He went all across the state campaigning and getting votes from people on the basis that once elected, he would bring into existence a minimum wage that was a real living wage, and he kept saying no worker should have to work and work hard for a living and then still remain in poverty. But once elected, his tune changed completely. He had a secret meeting with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, which we call the Business Caucus in the Minnesota Democratic Party, and he promised them that the first installment in the minimum wage increase would not go over $8 an hour. We all know that's an, you know, a miserly and paltry minimum wage. And yet that's what he promised the Chamber of Commerce, and that's what the Democrats delivered for the Chamber of Commerce. That was the switch. Baited people with, you know, saying that it should be a living wage. In fact, you know, he ran on the platform. He kept pointing out the platform of the Democratic Party as he was running. And I'm the one that wrote that in the platform. So I know what the platform says. If anybody wants to look on the Internet, they can read it. And it says, under labor and employment, it says, we promote the American labor movement and the rights of all workers. We support, and I quote, a minimum wage that keeps pace with inflation and provides full-time workers with an income above the poverty level. Programs to promote, and that they support programs to promote full employment. You know, once elected, he went totally against that. They're having a minimum wage increase. It is a raise in the minimum wage from a paltry $6.15 an hour to $9.50, which goes into effect in 2016. And, you know, we'll get an $8 increase here in Minnesota in August and another $8.50 to $9 later, and then finally the $9.50. And they promised that they would have this minimum wage index to inflation. Well, that index to inflation goes into effect in 2018. You know, this
2018.
Yeah, and it's capped. The index to inflation is capped. It can't go above 2.5%. You know, get out a calculator and do the math. 2.5% of $9.50 an hour. That's, you know, like 18-20 cents an hour. You know, and this is 4 years from now. It's almost unbelievable that these people would dare to pull this kind of bait and switch. If they tried to do this, if this was in retail, they would be sitting in prison for doing something as openly, you know, bait and switch as this. And yet they get away
with
it.
And that's what they do in retail. And that's what they do in retail. They show up with the handcuffs and they cart them off to jail.
Exactly. And then they force the person, the company that's doing the advertising to sell them, the people the product at those prices that they advertised. You know, there's nobody to force this Governor Dayton to come forward and now institute a real living minimum wage. And what's really, you know, it's mind-boggling and disgraceful, but Governor Dayton, he's a billionaire. And the way he, you know, got his billions of dollars, his family owned the Dayton Hudson Company, which is now Target Stores. So his billions of dollars were made off of poverty wages paid to working people.
Right.
You know, and this is, and he's supposed to be a great, he calls himself a progressive, he calls himself a liberal, and then he stabs working people in the back like this. It's literally sickening. You know, how these
Alan,
people can
one
do
things-
that live with themselves, I don't know.
One of the things we see here in California politics is we see how during election time they come up with these propositions and, you know, where they're going to spend billions and billions of dollars to help to create jobs and restore the economy here in California. And then after people vote on these bond measures and, you know, for this funding to create jobs, is always associated with jobs. And then people run to the polls and they vote for these lying politicians that say that they want to create these jobs. If you vote for these funds, if you vote for these packages that I'm presenting, and once they're voted into office, you know, the monies, usually people vote for these bond measures, but the monies are squandered. The monies are squandered, and the jobs are never created. They're never created, Alan. And this is another form of baiting and switching. They make these promises so they can get voted into office. And then the switch is we got the money, but we're not going to create the jobs that we promised, but they actually give the money to the financial backers to help to fund their campaigns. And we see this, it's rampant here in California. It's trickled down all the way from the Capitol all the way down to the local levels. And the Democrats, as you mentioned, Alan, they have become masters at it. They are the masters. And then we're going to focus a little bit about many of the promises. One of the biggest moves that the Democrats did in 2007 and 2008, they had a master plan of baiting and switching where people would say, well, we won't vote for the other candidates, but we will vote for Obama. And it was based on the promises that he made. They all sound good. And some of the broken promises, and we're going to talk about how the baiting and switching. The bait is something that sounds really good. I want to vote for this guy because he's telling me exactly what I want to hear. And it's only a promise because you're waiting for him to deliver on the promise after he is elected. What I can't understand, Alan, is why people came back and voted him in a second time, because many of them were saying, well, you had to consider he really inherited a mess. But in his first 4 years, Alan, he really created a mess. let's focus on some of them. In 2008, just some of the broken problems. What are you going to say, Alan?
I was just going to say these bonding proposals that you mentioned, this is going on all across the country, and people think they believe that these are great job creation programs. You know,
they're not.
If you study these bonding proposals, and this is important because I don't think too many people look at these.
They don't read it.
Right off the top, These companies that sell the bonds get a huge commission to start with, and these are Wall Street people that sell the bonds. And then on top of that, you get these where it's public works projects that are involved, be it highways or community centers. You get these architects that make big money, and you get the construction companies that make huge profits. And, affirmative action has not been enforced any place on any of these public programs since Obama's been in office. So, you know, the people come out on the short end no matter how you look at it, and they get stuck paying for these bonding proposals for 30, 40, 50, 60 years. And they're paying interest upon interest to these bankers who are reaping huge, huge profits off of all these bonding proposals, you know. And all we're doing is subsidizing the banks through these bonding proposals. We should have a federal publicly owned bank to fund all this stuff, and we could get rid of all these Wall Street people in the process.
On the federal, state, and also the local levels. That's it should be handled on all levels of government when you're talking about having a bank like that. And I think that's what you're saying.
Right, that's what I think we need in this country, public banking. And people don't realize our schools are going bankrupt literally bankrupt to the banks because of all these bonding bills that they passed to build a school.
Alan, let's look at some of these things. Let's look at some of these bills that they have. They always use education. You know, we have to take care of our young. You know, we have to make certain that we have high quality education. again, it becomes a lie. We have to create jobs, you know. Again, it becomes it's a lie. They are saying that we need to make certain that we have, you know, our water is supplied throughout the state. Again, it becomes a lie. It's a bond issue, but it becomes a lie. We have situations with the homeless. We need to have shelters. People, again, they go and vote for these bond measures, and again, it's a lie. And Alan, it's one lie after another. It's bait and switch. You know, they right. bait people to the voting booth to go and cast their vote for their to get elected into office. They do not produce on their promises.
Yeah.
Alan, let's look at a federal level, how they have created another means by which they can bait and switch. In other words, now they have what they call a sequester. You know, they can promise anything, but then Congress has the right where they can say, well, with our sequester here, we can make that, we can nullify that. Can you explain what sequester and the powers that Congress have with this legislation that they have in Washington?
Well, all that it does is give these politicians the right to conduct the people's business in secrecy. And,
exactly.
That's what it actually means. They use big fancy terms, but all they're doing is conducting the business of the people behind our backs. So by the time they get done with their business deals, it's a done deal and there's nothing that can be done about it. And people find out maybe what's the scandal that's taking place maybe 2, 3, 4, 5 years later. And, you know, the whole – that was another part of the bait and switch with Obama. He promised a transparent government, and there's never been a more closed government in the history of this country than under the Obama administration.
Well, you know, if I remember correctly, when he was running for president, he had mentioned that people, that they would have the opportunity to be able to look at any laws before they were passed, and where they would have like several days where they could be able to examine those laws, and that was part of the transparency. But,
right.
Alan, that hasn't happened either.
No,
again, that was part of the bait and switch. Am I correct on that?
You're correct, in my opinion. You know, we see that with Obamacare, where literally to find out if you have any rights at all under Obamacare, you have to hire an attorney to tell you what those rights are. We see corporations hiring these law firms to tell them how to get out from under paying for people's health care benefits now with Obamacare. All that, you know, every single issue where Obama promised the people something, it's been a bait and switch. Every single issue, we haven't had one promise fulfilled by Obama and his administration or the Democrats. With the minimum wage and these important issues for working people, Obama went into office. When he first came into office, he had a majority in the U.S. Senate. He had a majority in the U.S. House. He could have passed all these things. Instead, he chose to help Wall Street and to bail out Wall Street. That was a huge, huge bait and switch because the people just hoped and hoped that Obama was going to take care of their needs. You know, people were hoping beyond hope that Obama was going to stop all these foreclosures and evictions. You know, people kicked out of their homes. People were told that they had an investment in homes and that investment would grow. And all that
right.
Owning a home has turned into a major
nightmare.
Nightmare, yeah. How else can you explain it? And
you're not even certain if you're a owner or a renter.
Exactly. And, it's like you say, it's been a nightmare for millions and millions of people. And they hoped that Obama was going to take care of this mortgage problem. And he's done nothing. To this very day, you can open up any newspaper and look in the back section and see, you know, if it's a small community, you maybe see dozens of home foreclosures listed. If you live in a major city, there might be 20 or 30 pages of these home foreclosures in the back of the newspapers. And, you know, instead of becoming less of a problem, it's become more of a problem. And, you know, people have bought the homes that people have lost, and now those people are losing the homes because they can't afford them. So, you know, this whole situation is just creating massive human misery, and there's no end to it. And people are going to have to take matters into their own hands and turn this country around.
Well, I just want to make a quick pause here, and then we're going to focus on some of the broken promises on the federal level. And the reason why I want to focus on the federal level is we have the Democrats, you know, this is basically their doing for the past 5 years. And I won't say just the Democrats, because I see the Republicans, the twin party, they rubber stamp everything. They rubber stamp everything. But we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again on the Socialist Insight. Alan comes on the program every other week, and today we're having a discussion with Alan, the art of baiting and switching for political capital. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Stuart.
Alan, it was a masterpiece of bait and switch in 2007 and 2008. Barack Obama bamboozled the entire nation, whites, blacks, Mexicans, Indians, everyone went to the polls voting for Barack Obama. I was a vice presidential candidate back in 2007 and 2008, a presidential candidate. Eventually, I was a vice presidential candidate with the Socialist Party USA. But many of my own supporters, many people on the left were saying, we need to vote for Barack Obama because he has a better line. He was promising lies. I was saying things that I really believed in, things I was ready to stand up for. But let's look at some of those things. Promises came out of 2008. We will strengthen the ability of workers to organize unions and fight to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. Can you explain a little bit about that? Did that ever happen, Alan?
It never happened, and it wasn't even given due consideration by Obama or the Congress. And
I don't see any indication that anything was ever done to make it so workers could organize in this country. Nothing.
No.
To the contrary.
It's become harder to organize in this country. And, in fact, you know, we've been a small group of people across the country have been working to try and put an end to this at-will employment business where workers can be fired by an employer for just because the employer wants to fire them. And, you know, we can't even get support to repeal and rescind at-will employment here in Minnesota, which has a Democratic supermajority. And we can't get one single member of the Progressive Caucus in Congress to support the rescinding and repealing at-will employment. This is something that is so basic. You know, a lot of people maybe don't think about this, but if a worker doesn't have any rights at work, they don't have any right to participate in the political process and in their community with anything. Because if an employer doesn't like what they're doing, all they have to do under at-will employment is fire the person.
Alan,
and,
you have no control over your livelihood.
Exactly. And when you have no control over your livelihood, you don't have any rights. I mean,
no,
basic,
you don't.
A worker without a job, what is a worker without a job? That's another working-class family that's going to live in poverty. And we've every year in this country, quite literally, and I'm not exaggerating, thousands of working people get fired from their jobs, putting their names on a union card. And, you know, this is supposed to be a democracy. And Obama and these people came into office promising the Employee Free Choice Act. You know, this is one of the big bait and switches of all time. It was the only promise that Obama made to organize labor. And, you know, these labor leaders, these millionaire labor leaders like Richard Trumka and Leo Girard and the 56 or 58 members of the AFL-CIO Executive Council, not one of these people have held Obama accountable for any of this. You know, instead, now they're even talking about campaigning and supporting Hillary Clinton. And, you know, if Obama's bad, Clinton's going to be worse.
Oh, you know, she's going to be worse.
Yeah. And,
Freddy Krueger.
You know, yeah, they talk about the lesser evil. Well, you know.
Who do you want? You want Jason? Do you want Jason or do you want Freddy Krueger? Take your pick.
Yeah, exactly. And we're in a terrible mess in this country. And until people begin to, you know, vote for candidates like yourself and other people that begin to run for office and oppose this, you know, things aren't going to change.
Alan, let's look at another one. This is another promise. This is part of the baiting and switching. You have to realize when dealers, when they tell you they're going to have that car for that $20,000 car for $15,000, you have to read the fine print. You know, in other words, how are you going to do this? How are you going to do it? You don't read the fine print where they say, well, you have to use our financing, you know, which is illegal. You know, the dealership may add accessories, which is illegal. The thing is, it's the fine print. But here's another one. We will ensure that federal employees, including public safety officers who put their lives on the line every day, have the right to bargain collectively. And we will fix the broken bargaining process at the Federal Aviation Administration. Did that happen?
No, not only did it not happen, Obama dictated that federal employees weren't going to get the raises they were entitled to, and there was no bargaining at all over that. And
We will fight to ban the permanent replacement of striking workers so that workers can stand up for themselves without worrying about losing their livelihoods. I think we just covered that one.
Well, 1,300 workers here in the Red River Valley, they were locked out of their jobs by American Crystal Sugar Company, and Obama never said one single word about that. He never put on his marching shoes like he promised he was going to do and to support working people in their struggles.
Never.
And this was a union local that supported Obama very heavily. In fact, the leader of the union walked around outside the locked plant gates with an Obama hat on. I mean, this is the epitome of stupidity to have these union leaders supporting Obama and these Democrats when they won't even do anything and they won't even show up on their when they're locked out to show support for them. And, you know, I put forward a resolution to end scabbing and lockouts here in Minnesota, and a resolution to put an end to at-will employment. And I brought those before the state convention of the Minnesota Democratic Farmer Labor Party. And guess who opposed it? It wasn't the head of the Chamber of Commerce. It was the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO. And he said that he was worried that if he supported those kinds of resolutions and proposals, that it would tear the Democratic Party apart. Because it would create this division between workers and business. And this is the kind of Democratic Party we have in this country, a Democratic Party that serves business but talks about being pro-labor. And, you know, this is one of the great bait and switches of all time. And this is what we can expect from the Democrats time and time and time again. We'll get the bait and the switch. You know, we haven't even talked about Internet freedom, Stuart. We're using the Internet right now, and Obama talked about how he was for net neutrality and Internet freedom.
Explain to our listeners what that means, Alan.
Well,
because
I
think a lot of our listeners are clueless when it comes to this.
It means that people have just as much right to have access to the Internet as corporations. And it recognizes that people really are people with rights and that corporations are not people with rights, and yet Obama is bringing the Internet into line with Citizens United. He's allowing corporations He wants corporations to have greater access and more speed on the Internet than what you or I would have. And he wants these corporations to be able to dominate the Internet so that you and I don't even have a chance to get access to the Internet to voice
our
views and opinions.
Limited or even possibly no access to the Internet.
Right.
And this is what's coming on the pipeline. And this is from, these are promises that were made. Promises, transparency, openness, you know, something that will work for the citizens of this country. But it hasn't. Here's another one, Alan. The workers' share in our country's productivity will expand the earned income tax credit and raise the minimum wage and index it to index it to inflation. But Alan, we haven't seen anything being indexed to what inflation is going right now. I mean, let's just talk about gasoline prices. I mean, I don't know what it's like where you're at, but I know if I go back 60 days, I'm paying just to go back and forth to work an additional $75 a month just to go to work. $75.
Right.
Alan, $75, I wish my employer would give me a pay raise for $75 for a month, you know? I haven't seen it.
Well,
actually, my income has gone down.
Exactly. And what we're not seeing, we're seeing the government using the levers of government to suppress wages and push wages down. And government should be using its levers and its power and authority to push the prices down and to control the cost of, so that we have a decent standard of living in this country. You know, how is it that it's so easy for government to control wages but not do anything to control prices? You know, people got to begin to question this. You know, we paid over $4 a gallon for propane to heat our homes this winter. Government never lifted a finger to put an end to this monopoly price fixing. And, you know, the same thing has happened with gasoline prices. We have a company called Holiday Stations here in Minnesota. I think there's a couple other states with Holiday Stations. But Holiday Stations passed out a leaflet saying that, well, gas prices are rising, but the gas prices didn't rise with inflation for many years. Well, that was their excuse for raising the gas prices. Why isn't the same reasoning applied towards wages? What if, you know, a leaflet was passed out that said that wages should rise with this inflation and, you know, and gas prices is rising, propane prices is rising, food prices in the store is rising, electric bills rising, you know, college education, the price of tuition is rising. All prices, goods and services are rising. We have a cost of living crisis in this country that every single working class family is experiencing, and these politicians can do nothing to control these prices. This is in total insanity, but they can control wages. It makes no sense at all. The very people that are producing the wealth of this country, the working people, have their wages suppressed at a time when profits are at an all-time high.
So, Alan, people need to understand when we're talking about baiting and switching, we need to hear all of these lies that are being promised to workers, like things that we've been focusing on, like minimum wage, how it's going to create jobs, paid sick leaves, all of these things, how it's going to include us more in the bargaining process, organized labor, and none of these promises have been fulfilled. None of these promises will be fulfilled by the Democrats and Republicans, but they're used as a means of baiting and switching. They bait people into the voting booth, vote for our candidate, and then after that we find out that all of this is a lie. So, Alan, I just want to very briefly just mention that we have Alan Mackey. He's joining our program once again on the Socialist Insight. And today our discussion is the art of baiting and switching for political capital. And Alan, thanks again for joining the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Alan, I just want to focus on, I don't want to dwell too much on this because I have a list of almost 100 things of these broken promises that have been made, and we don't have a list to go through that. I shouldn't say broken promises. I should just come right out and say outright lies. But, Alan, I want to focus on one of the big issues. One of the big issues that was that people, when they went to the voting booth in 2008, President Obama promised people, he say, if you vote for me within 9 months of me, 9 months of getting into office, I'm going to have all of our troops out of Iraq and Afghanistan and bring an end to these wars. Alan, was that a broken promise?
Yeah, that was the biggest bait and switch of all time, because people, if there was one question where the American people were united on more than any other question, it was on the question of peace. You know, all the polls show that between 70% and 80% of the American people want an end to these dirty imperialist wars, and they want that money used for socially useful and necessary things that our society needs and that people need. And they really expected that Obama was going to deliver peace. I think that's probably the number one issue that got Obama elected, is that he said that he was the candidate of peace. And this was the biggest bait and switch of all. And we've had nothing but war after war after wars. There's never been any peace in this country since Obama's been president. And,
I was surprised one time he looked at it very jokingly, saying that he's become very good at killing, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't see it as a joking matter, but I mean, he had a little chuckle behind that. You know, I'm good at killing people, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound like a president is looking for peace, huh?
No, this is the mentality of these people that are in power. It's the worst kind of jingoism and national chauvinism that it imaginable. It's right on par with the kind of jingoism and chauvinism that Hitler shut down the throats of the German people. And this country is following in the same footsteps. And, you know, it's, right now we're on the verge of World War III, in my opinion, over this whole crisis in the Ukraine. And Obama keeps getting us further and further towards war in this situation. You'd think that he would back off a little, and instead of backing off, he sends the head.
Alan, that's a good point that you brought up. Are Americans being baited into another war?
Yeah,
because
for sure
I see all this propaganda on television. I mean, it just makes it seem like the other guys are the bad guys, but are Americans being baited into another war that here we need to defend our freedoms and here's a country that has invaded another country? To me, it sounds like we're talking about more baiting and switching, but baiting and switching there is taking it to an all-new level.
For sure. It's, you know, two world wars have started in this region of the world, and Obama isn't even proceeding with any kind of caution, knowing that that's what's happened. And it was this same kind of, you know, disputes that led to World War One and World War Two, and you got some of the exact same players that were involved in starting World War Two that are involved in the Ukraine, these fascist elements. You have these fascist elements involved in Latvia, and these other Balkan countries, Lithuania. And it's these fascist elements that took us into World War II, and here we got Obama cuddling up to these people, outright fascists. They're Nazis. They march through the streets carrying Nazi swastikas and piling.
They're very open.
Led us to World War II, yeah.
And Alan, we don't see this. I mean, we don't see any of this on this television. I mean, I love my wife, you know, she sits in front of the television. She watched the morning news, and then she watched the 8 o'clock news, and then she wanted to watch the 9 o'clock news, and then the 10 o'clock news. And I was saying, well, you know, you saw all of that, all of this. You saw it at 6 o'clock in the morning. You know, so it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But Alan, we're watching all. I mean, all this garbage is being fed. I mean. Years ago, back around the time of the Second World War, they would go and see these newsreels, and they would see those in these theaters. Now all this garbage is being pumped into your home 24/7. But
exactly.
Alan, yeah, what is so dangerous about this is that people are they're buying into war. They're buying into more the lies of a government that said that they were going to bring peace, but as you know, quite to the contrary, they're bringing us more war. But Alan, this, like I say, this is the ultimate bait and switch. But another thing, when we were talking about, and this is something I've spoken to Stephen Katz on our other program, is this president. When we talk about our freedoms, and we look at our rights under habeas corpus here in the country, where you know if you're arrested, you know they have to show proof of why are you going to detain me. But even Alan, even this is being taken away from us. This is worse than this is just as bad or worse than what we saw. In Germany, because we see now people being locked up that many Americans don't even know are being locked up for, you know, year after year after year with no rights to representation. Again, this is part of the bait and switch that people are buying into this because it's for national defense. We're fighting terrorism, but they're buying into this.
Well, yeah, because they're bombarded with a day in and day out. When people get bombarded with lie after lie, it becomes believable. And a healthy country would have some discussion and debate about on these issues. Our country is not healthy at all because the debate and the discussion isn't even tolerated. If people begin to talk about some of these things, you know, you have the FBI hounding and harassing people. Go out on the street corner and you set up a little table informing people about what's going on in the Ukraine, or you talk about full employment, or you talk about raising the minimum wage to a real living wage. And some cop's going to come along and tell you that you're being disorderly, that you're stopping the flow of the pedestrians. You know, they will not tolerate any kind of discussion being brought to the American people questioning any of this. It's just intolerable. And these people want total domination of the way we think in this country. And they want to control and manipulate public opinion so it looks like the American people are supporting these wars. And when, in fact, you know, you can only say that you support something when you've heard all sides of the question. So,
right.
You know, you'll see in all these wars, little wars that on the polls when Obama first gets involved, oh, yeah, everybody's for it, you know. And you'll see poll figures showing 60-70% for it, and then the body bags start coming back and people start seeing the destruction, and all of a sudden public opinion changes because a new aspect is being added to the discussion. Well, these things should be talked about before we go to war, and the American people should have a say in all this. You know, what's going on in Ukraine is a terrible, terrible thing because we're being manipulated and controlled, and we're being lied to day in and day out. You know, for the head of the CIA to go over there and to instigate more problems and more trouble, this is just total insanity. How does Obama even dare do something like that, you know? And then he says that the Russians have no right to have a say in anything, and it's on their borders that all this is happening.
Alan, I mean, here you have countries that are putting a line of defense missiles around your borders. In other words, they're going to get you on your back doorsteps. and they're going to get you on your front doorsteps, and they're going to get you on your southern doorsteps, and then they say you don't have a right to even enter this discussion.
Right.
What is that all about?
Well,
and Americans are buying into this crapola.
Yeah, I don't know if people are really buying into it because they haven't had the chance to hear any other sides of the story. You know, if you talk to the average person, they haven't had a chance to hear really anything about what's going on over there in Ukraine. And
right. Surprisingly, a lot of Americans don't even know where the Ukraine is.
Yeah, exactly. And they're not gonna get another side unless people get out in the streets and start protesting and raising hell about what Obama is doing. Then people will see that there's some people questioning things, and there must be some reason to question. And then people will start looking into it a little further. That's the way things happen. And you know, unless the peace movement in this country has almost been totally silenced and sucked in by Obama. We've got all these people talking about, you know, Obama's so great and everything, and give Obama a chance. Well, how much more of a chance do we have to give this guy? And you've got the leaders of the peace movement talking like this.
Well, Alan, let's face it, the peace movement received a knife in the back with the Occupy movement. It was growing. People were going out in the streets. They felt like here and now we have an opportunity to speak against all these injustices and how this administration and this government is not working for us. And first they sent the press out and act like they were basically to assimilate, and then it was to destroy. I mean, they started,
right.
I mean, I know friends of mine now, they have given them a choice in the courts. Either, you know, you remove yourself out of these organizations and not participate, or you're going to find yourself in jail. You'll lose your job. I mean, Alan, this has been done to tens of thousands of people across the country. In other words, you're not to get involved in this anymore. I mean, so they have taken away their constitutional rights. These are things that we're not hearing about.
Right.
That's
now,
what's
going
on, Alan.
The FBI is going around talking to people's employers if people are involved in peace demonstrations and everything. And they'll say, oh, we're just conducting an investigation. We're not here to, you know, harass or hassle anybody. But what does it mean when the FBI goes to an employer and says, do you know your employee has been involved in this demonstration or this activity? And, you know, there's nothing illegal about what these people are doing. But it's the FBI just going to that employer and planning in that employer's mind that they got to get rid of this employee, or otherwise they're going to be in trouble too, you know. And Obama has taken this all to a new level. He did that when he admitted he's sending 500 FBI agents to disrupt the Occupy movement. They were very worried. Obviously, people understood that Wall Street is our enemy. And when people understand that, it's only a matter of time before they start challenging their enemy for political and economic power. And this government, you know, this Wall Street bribe government was deathly afraid that the American people were going to begin to challenge Wall Street for political and economic power. And that's why the FBI was sent in to disrupt this anti-Wall Street movement.
Alan, I'm going to hit on a few of these real quick because we have like around 10 minutes. Alan, I want to tell you I really appreciate you coming on and discussing this, the art of baiting and switching for political capital, because we can see that the Democrats and the Republicans and Wall Street, they are very good at that. And the reason why I'm saying Wall Street, because they're the ones financing these campaigns. They're putting in their representatives. But
They hire the professionals, Stuart. Wall Street has the money, and they bring in these Madison Avenue advertising executives who give Hollywood the orders of how to carry out this whole scheme to hoodwink the American people and, like you say, bamboozle the American people. This is costing billions of dollars to pull this crap over on the American people. And, you know, we're going to have to find a better way to start exposing all of this.
Alan, just getting into this baiting and switching, because people have to realize the big bait and switch, it happened 5 years ago, 6 years ago, back in 2007. And Alan, you know, it's ongoing. But I will sign any non-emergency, I will not sign any non-emergency bill without giving the American public an opportunity to review and comment on the White House website for 5 days. For
yep.
5 days. Alan, is that available to you?
No.
I can't even get on the White House website.
In fact, you know,
I think it's down.
People used to be able to write a letter to the president and at least get some kind of response from somebody, you know, designated to respond to letters.
Oh, don't write
now,
a letter now.
A letter
the NSA is looking at you.
Yeah, exactly. You get on a, you know, a list if you write a letter criticizing Obama's, you know, bait and switch. And, you know, this is the whole thing. This is part of the repression that's taking place in this country. It's a very active campaign of repression, and it's happening in a way that they, you know, it keeps getting worse and worse, and you don't even notice it until it happens to you. And
right.
You know,
oh,
because,
yeah, it's happened to
so
me. And I might mention, after it happened to me, I got a notice in the mail saying that I could be fined up to $5,000 just because I wrote something and did a CC to the president. I say, well, $5,000 just because I CC'd the White House? You know,
yeah.
I didn't vote for the guy, but I thought at least I had a right to let him know what was going on in a branch of, you know, one of his agencies, you know, like, oh, you
right.
can be fined up to $5,000 for, you know, sending that letter. And I mean, if we have not gotten our troops out by the time I am president, it will be the first thing that I will do. I will get our troops home, and we'll end this war. You can take that to the bank.
Oh.
Well, I guess that bank is bankrupt.
Yeah.
We support constitutional protection and judicial oversight on any surveillance programs involving Americans. I don't think that happened, Alan.
All we got is our telephones tapped in a massive way.
Okay. We reject sweeping claims of inherent presidential powers. In other words, people bought into that because why should George Bush get all these, I mean, have all these presidential powers where he can do this and that? I mean, the presidential powers that this president has right now, Alan, I mean, it puts what Bush was doing to shame.
Yeah, and ironically,
People are buying into this. They bought into it in 2008. Alan, where I'm surprised is they came back. You know, they were promised one thing and then a big switch. And the switch, Alan, has affected all of us. I mean,
it sure has. And
we will revisit
the
Patriot Act, and we will revisit the Patriot Act and overturn unconstitutional executive decisions issued during the past 8 years. Well, they over, you know, they revisit it and didn't do anything about it, and then they came out with the National Defense Authorization Act. In other words, they reinforced it.
Right.
Am I missing something here?
No. You're covering it pretty well, I think. And I don't think you can find one single thing where Obama said he was going to do something for the people where he actually did it. I can't think of anything. And, you know, ironically, they've been able to trick people into believing that things like Obamacare are really going to be helpful to the people. You know, and you've got people saying that we got to defend Obamacare against the Republicans. Well, what is there in Obamacare to defend? Just like there's nothing in Obama's proposed $10.10 an hour for the minimum wage to defend, and yet these people are trying to make us believe that it's something better than what the Republicans would have delivered. You know, it's one poverty wage being substituted for another poverty wage. You know, and you can go right down the line like we already have, and it's right one thing after another. Every single promise has been broken. He campaigned on doing things that would help the people, and people believed it. People were desperate to believe it after years of George Bush, and all they did is get another Bush administration shoved down their throats with Barack Obama.
And in the next few months, we're going to start hearing these promises from Miss Hillary.
Yeah, it looks like it might be Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush. Isn't that a great choice? People
oh, yeah.
have enough pull out of democracy.
Oh, yeah. We saw this a few weeks ago during the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson, where he made his speech and his famous war on poverty. He did some things. He didn't do enough. But what we saw is Barack Obama, he made a new promise for new revenues of opportunities for generations through a federal program aimed to improve the poorest areas of America. We have seen recently where he just let Detroit just go right down the tube. I mean, he didn't even lift
right.
a finger, you know. But we have seen this in Pennsylvania. We have seen it in parts of the South and Alabama. Alan, I've seen it right here in California, where he talked about these promise zones, but. Alan, this is another bait and switch. I mean, they're already prepping people for the election that's going to take place this year, and they're prepping people for the Democrats and the leadership for 2015 and 2016 that will be bombarding people with more lies. But what about this presidential, these promise zones? It seemed like it's just promising more lies.
Well, it is. There's nothing to it at all. If anything, Obama will make these zones where corporations can come in and, exploit the working people even further than what Wall Street is right now. And it's making available cheap labor to these corporations where workers will have even fewer rights than they have now. You know, they come up with all these names, promise zones, nuclear warheads become peacekeepers. You know, it's just a total brainwash that they conduct against the American people, and it goes on until they're challenged.
I want to ask you, Alan, are the Republicans any better?
No, for sure the Republicans are no better. We're going to have to find a way to start a brand new political party or political movement that's based on what working people really need in this country. And until we do that, things aren't going to change, Stuart.
You think we'll be able to do that before the next war, or will it be after the next war? Because if it's after the next war, that'll probably be like around 300 or 400 years from now. But if it's before
exactly.
the next war, we need to do that within the next few weeks. But when will this happen, creating this political power party?
Well, people are going to have to start to consider this and mull things over, and they're going to have to make a decision whether they want, you can only push these wars so far, and all it takes is, one country to make a mistake that takes us into World War III, and before you know it, there's nuclear weapons flying all over the place, and like you say, I don't even know if we can recover in 300 or 400 years if there's a nuclear war.
No. Alan, I want you to take a minute, because I really believe in the new Progressive Alliance. I want you just to take around a minute to explain what that is, because I believe that that's a clear direction that working people need to get behind today. What is the new the NPA?
Well, the new Progressive Alliance is a group that's come together. Essentially what we're saying is that we need a new political movement in this country based on issues. As far as what the party is called isn't really important. The important thing is that peace be on top of the agenda, and that there be a program for full employment, for real living wages, and that we reorder the priorities of this country away from war and military spending. That's the gist of what the New Progressive Alliance is about, and we hope that people will look into it. All they have to do is Google New Progressive Alliance, and they can come across our website and see what kinds of things we're
and Alan, how
and doing.
Can people reach you? Because I really appreciate you joining our program. How can people reach you so they can follow up on what you have had to share today?
People can call me at 651-587-5541, or they can leave a message on my home phone, 218-386-2432. or simply Google my name, Alan Mackey, A-L-A-N-M-A-K-I, and I'll come across my blog with all my contact information.
And Alan, I thank you once again for joining our program, and I thank our listeners for joining the Socialist Insight. Ruth Ann, and have a good night. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me, Stuart.
Thank you, guys. You're listening to Aramarte Fio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. And welcome to the dialogue. I'm Ruth Ann, and Ken is here. This is his vision. So, Ken, take over.
Hello. So, today we got a bunch of thinkers to discuss moneyless societies, reasons for them, why they may be coming. We're kind of leave it open, see where it goes, and We'll let the conversation kind of dictate the path. So, do we have everyone online right now?
We have Angel and we have Copal.
All right. Well, probably a smart thing is let Angel and Copal introduce themselves, and then we'll go from there.
Good evening. I hope everyone's okay today. My name is Angel Marrero, and I am the fire keeper for Green Circle Alliance for Turtle Island here in the U.S., and I'm also working directly with Ken and a specific group of individuals, of thinkers, to transform the planet into something a lot different and a lot better following community and spirituality, in a sense. And I am so happy to be here, and I appreciate you allowing me the time to speak with you guys.
All right. Copal? Is she still in there? Do we have her?
She's there.
Did we lose her?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
So.
Hi. Sorry about that. Hey, guys. I was trying to use my headphones, and I just...
fun.
wasn't plugging in right. But anyway, hi. Happy to join everybody. I'm just a conscious co-creator. I'm not putting any other labels on myself. I'm just a generally interested in the advancement of humanity past the current paradigm of, you know, stuckness that we're all in. And obviously, all of us have various stages of projects we're working on. I'm trying to get moving and, you know, have felt, you know, different levels of frustration about the limitations on the planet. But we're obviously here to kind of move past those barriers in a way which supports each other. So, like, I'm basically here as, you know, a conscious co-creator with all of you and very happy to be in the space of, you know, free thinkers and new energy. It feels really good.
All right.
It does feel good. You're right.
So I guess we've been kind of trying to get this sort of rolling for a minute. So this being day one of this conversation, and we've all had this conversation as individuals with each other quite a bit recently, and I think, you know, watching Bitcoin, watching the Fed, and really just watching the dollar disappear and wondering about better ways to do this, maybe we should start with discussing how a society without money would operate. How would we? What would be the substitutes? Since we're kind of stuck on this mechanism of using a dollar, what ideas do you guys have?
Well, I personally, I think that I like transitions a lot myself, and I think that the transition that we're going to be having within, I don't even want to put a time limit on it, but I think all the countries of the world are going to be using the same kind of money before too long. And because we know now the dollar isn't nearly what it used to be, and others like in Asia, they're using the yen much more than the dollar. So this change is taking place. So I think we're going to go into one type of money before we go to money less. This is my own opinion. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that we just need to get moving on it. Because if you have one type of currency, at least everybody would, you know, it would be the same instead of someone in Southeast Asia making 40 cents an hour or less. Everybody across the country would, across the world, would be making a certain amount of whatever. So I think that that might be a transitional stage. As far as money less, I think this will be wonderful because we won't have bills. As such, if we don't worry about the corporations making a profit, if we don't have these major corporations, because their first goal, their mission statement, is to make a profit for their shareholders. So if we don't have them, we don't have to worry about a profit. And I think that's going to make a major difference in our lives.
Well, there's a... go ahead, Angel. Go ahead.
I agree with that. I think, you know, one of the major issues that I see is that corporations have become almost like single entities capable of influencing and controlling with their power and money everything from, you know, what you can buy to what you're supposed to eat to, you know, the political powers of the world, who's actually in the ruling class of the government. And I think that, one of the things I've seen in corporations working in my past here on the planet in corporations, working for generating business for companies like Microsoft and then finding out, you know, what they're truly apparently up to, really put a bad taste in my mouth, I know that for sure. But money is seen to be something that's taught to everybody from childhood, and it started somewhere. Because I know for sure that, you know, when you look at the U.S., that the native tribes here, you know, have had a, you know, so-called moneyless system built off of trade and sharing and helping one another and community. And I think that's one thing that's been lost is true community. Without that, it's hard to get to true civilization, which I don't believe has been found yet. I definitely agree with you on that. Corporations have a big deal to lose in a moneyless society, and they're going to fight tooth and nail to keep it. And
yes.
You know, what do we do about that?
One of the things that I guess this is like when you hear people complain about the scenario or say it'll never work or blah, 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 you can't fix it because we're stuck on the dollar to the point where everybody's life is trapped right now, which, you know, and depending how weird you want to go with this, that was an intended future, but to get out, there's like this multi-tiered process. One, corporations have to not, I almost feel like they can't change, like they're not going to be able to, and so the new corporations have to take this idea of what a corporation should act like and formulate themselves to that. And then in turn, you know, they're, for one, needing less money by far, lots less, and they can put that into more social issues, philanthropic issues, whatever, and obviously pay the board and CEOs a lot less money. But to, you almost have to let the dinosaurs die and start with a clean slate just to get rid of money, but in turn also design a company that can learn to function without while still supplying all these goods. Like, people have to, it's to phase it out. I've never put a lot of thought into that, like how difficult that can be, other than passive force by, like, a complete government collapse where the dollar is just done and gone. And I don't know, you know, that's, it's a weird subject to really, to how do you transition? Ruth Ann, that was a damn good point. Like, I don't know how to transition. I know I'm phasing my life doing small things, you know, grow my own food. We do pretty much our healthcare preventative style now, and then we do very holistic, lots of herbs, and we're getting more into a lot of energy work and healing that way and keeping that in the house, so the house is a lot healthier.
Right.
I've trimmed my bills down as far as I can go, and hopefully, you know, with a little bit of effort and investment in the house, I can get rid of some utilities, but it's not everybody has that capability. Like, say someone that lives in, you know, in the middle of a city and is on welfare. How do they transition out of using money?
That's where the community
comes
in. Yeah. And I think what we haven't mentioned is this cannot just be a one-country thing because we do so much business around the world. It's got to be worldwide.
Yeah.
As a very large infrastructure. Yeah.
One of the things I was going to bring up is the idea of time banking, because people are used to the idea of bank. So to kind of debunk the concept of bartering, which doesn't really work, because bartering only works if you have an equal exchange and desire. So like if one person has something the other person needs. But in a time bank scenario, which works very well, you create a database of people with various skills and things to offer, even if you have, like a pair of tickets you want to barter off, and they may be very valuable tickets, but you can't go. So you put those on the time bank. Or, you know, you have a skill as a gardener. You put an hour, you commit an hour to doing something, you log it in the bank, and then you go and get out of that bank what you need. So say you need someone to come fix your plumbing. You go to a plumber and harvest their hour or two. And so it debits and credits based on the internal skill and currency of the person, or, you know, assets that that person has to offer. There's an example of it out in Portland called Hour Exchange. Portland. It's a time bank scenario, and it's working really well. There's all kinds of professionals using it. People are getting, like, health care in exchange for, like, their window getting fixed. So, I mean, there's no limit on the types of currencies that can be generated. It's just a matter of breaking the concept of currency as money. So the consciousness around money is the key. The installation of a different set of values. And,
you know, there was go ahead.
No, I was just going to say most of us are just trapped in thinking that value equals.
Well, I got a great example on that. We tried to start a time bank out here, and it's sort of in limbo, mainly because the only people that can use it, putting their services in, are people that have what you would consider low-end services, which then applies, we have to rethink our value of services. Like, for instance, someone who does Reiki versus a brain surgeon, or even better, a mechanic versus a brain surgeon.
Right.
And I keep getting asked that. All right, here's the barter. I'm a dentist. And you have to cover the fact that I've got this education.
that I have to pay for, so my fees are high because I've got insurance and education to cover, and then the lifestyle that falls in with it because most people chase the dragon and end up buying McMansions and whatnot. But the core problem is that we have an education system that, once again, tied to money, costs so much money that everybody's got to charge insane amounts of money for a service. But then again, there's also this ego, the clout of, I'm a brain surgeon. Don't put me at the same level of hour as my mechanic, which...
Yeah.
Well, that's hierarchy, though. People are used to hierarchy. Oh, I didn't catch what someone was saying. We're all...
I think we might have hit something good there.
The brain surgeon can't get where he needs to go without his car running. And as far as the educational costs, we're talking about a time when education is going to be free. So that makes a difference. I mean, right now, again, it's transition, and people have to get over their ego thing, I mean, the brain surgeon. I think when we get into it, though, a lot of these people with the income of a brain surgeon and all, I've been surprised. Some of them are very much for this kind of thing, and they aren't running around with their ego. So
yeah.
We may be pleasantly surprised there.
They're trapped by insurance fees. Is oftentimes why they have to go overboard in charging. So, I do think that there has to be some type of rollover where insurance and, kind of like that kind of insurance from disaster, we could have to prepare for that differently too. So a different type of concept for insurance is also important for banking and insurance go hand in hand. They're inextricable in this world, especially in the United States. It's like people are afraid of getting sued. That pushes up the fees. Everybody thinks they're more valuable than the next person. That pushes up the insurance. It's like a crazy loop.
It is. And I'm glad this is all coming up because the one thing that I see the lack of, what we're discussing here and how things are in the world is there's a lack of mind, body, and soul connection, which... brings about a different type of consciousness in the human beings on the planet as a whole. So I definitely believe that, the educational process here on the planet, and there's some places that are a little bit different and are making changes, but a lot here in the U.S. specifically too, since I'm in the U.S., has to do with what they teach, how they teach it, the importance that they teach behind certain things. And this goes all the way back, not just in universities, by the way. I'm going all the way back to, primary schooling, from Head Start on up. What are we teaching our children? So the descendants at this point of our planet are really going to be the heroes of everything, and what we do to set it up for them to do that is going to be very important. But I believe that spirituality, that the soul and the connection between mind, body, and soul, that specifically medicine and, in general, has forgotten in the Western countries, the Westernized countries, is something that's truly lacking. With soul connection to the mind and body, you have a complete healing. And, even on the ambulance you see going by, you see the symbol, the snakes on the pole. The mind, body, and soul connection, which is a symbol that most people don't even understand. And, it's very important, I believe, that connection is remade. And there are certain people out there that get it, and I think the uniting of the like minds is the first, and major part of the transition, like we are here today. We may be in different places, but we're uniting our minds, and I know for sure that each of you has some type of spiritual, connection to yourself and to the universe around you. I think that's one of the main things that has been forgotten. It leads to consciousness. And that consciousness can lead to change in how we raise our descendants on this planet. I don't think that we're going to, I don't believe yet that we're going to make a huge change or a huge dent in the planet as a whole, because people have come so far with regards to, you know, how they think and how they've been raised and how the reinforcement of what they believe and how they've been raised is executed via the educational process. You know, and then, you know, we have all of these other elements like substances that people do not know how to utilize, that they abuse, and they become in a lost world of fabrication. You know, the world around us is a fabricated thing. It's to me, it's not even the reality, you know, and getting connected to what is truly real anymore has a lot to do with that consciousness of soul and mind and body connection. And I think that's really something that's lacking here, and we can really do a better job for our children and their children and so on.
Hello?
Go ahead.
Is
Karen?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Yay.
Yeah, I made it. Me and Brett are together here, and we weren't able to get on Skype. But what I kind of want to jump in on, and I kind of want to peg on a word that you were saying, and that's the word education. I'm a 20-year veteran of homeschooling. And so I learned to change all my terminology around learning, because education implies a system, and a system is a very bloated. Usually the top number one cost of any state in the United States is the education system, and as a matter of fact, the number one paid teacher in the education system of any state is usually a football coach. So we definitely have a values issue right there about education, learning, knowing, and understanding. And sort of my thought about going or transitioning to a moneyless society is money is a way to measure scarcity. So what we've allowed in our society is to make something scarce that should be abundant. We're in a unique position now with technology to take learning and make it an abundant situation using technology, and take it out of the sort of hierarchical construct that's pretty primitive. I mean, we're talking about a technology, schooling as a technology, which is archaic compared to if we switch things around and start talking about human learning, understanding, and even knowing, like you were talking about, Angel, you were talking about the soul, learning from the inside out.
That's
so
right.
A key transition in my mind is taking that which we've allowed to make scarce and therefore is measured by money, perversely, and saying, wait a minute, you don't have to learn out of a book. You can learn from within yourself, you can learn from other people, and you can learn using technology. And the number one cost of education most people don't know is textbooks. So we're talking about, you know, how old is the textbook technology? I think it came right after scrolls, right? You know, kids have in their pocket more access to knowledge with their cell phone, their smartphone, than they would have in the Library of Alexandria, I'll put together, I'm pretty sure. And again, it is quality, but the quality part and the values part comes from reaching within yourself and finding out what you value, and that is the key to everything, is the values that we have, is start unmonetizing certain things. If there's an abundance, take advantage of it. Digital stuff doesn't cost anything to print, right? And also not allow the society to make something scarce that wasn't scarce in the first place. I worked a lot volunteering with preserving a well, an artesian well in my town that I used to live in. Water, it didn't used to be a scarcity, but they're fast making it a scarcity by how it's managed worldwide, and it's basically managed by the corporate mindset that it is a commodity and eventually will be worth more per barrel than oil is now. So, and a lot of the things that's causing that to become a scarcity is how we manage it, and things like fracking, which we're literally wiping out the supply and making it a scarcity so it becomes monetized, and then we'll have one more thing we have to undo later. So that's my two cents, and if you guys let Brett come in here, he'll tell you a few things too, but he's right here with me.
Nice.
You want me to get Brett over here? For just a minute,
well,
we got a phone that may wink out on us, so we're going to try to jump in ahead and then let you guys be the wise people that you are. Here's Brett.
Hello.
One of the Hi. Hi, Brett.
Hi. How are you? Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Good to meet you, Brett.
How is everybody?
Welcome.
Oh, good. We're finally here.
Yeah, I like what you guys are saying, you know, that is really what needs to be done. And everything you were saying was, you know, pretty right on, you know. And there are some very practical things that people can do, too, you know, like, you know, make a garden, you know, make basically forage for food. Because every state has an abundance of food that you can forage for at any time of the year, even, you know, in the coldest winter, you know.
Yep.
So, yeah, there's a lot we can do, especially, you know, when things really turn over. There, like Karen said, there's going to be a scarcity of lots of things, you know. So yeah. People need a real practical thing to be able to do right off, you know. There's different ways that people can keep warm, you know, and where they can eat, you know. So these things are going to be immediate, you know, when things happen, if they happen or whenever they happen, you know, I would say.
I agree. There's like education is like the huge, huge underlying factor that Karen was saying. The education of the sources of scarcity is going to be the way people debunk the consciousness around the money trap, the money web, because even money itself is a commodity. People don't even know that money is traded, just like a bag of flour or, you know, oil, which is, you know, backing the current dollar system. And even you go take a step further and realize that oil is not even what they say it is. If you talk to any really wise geologists, they know that oil is not a fossil, not from the fossilized remains of anything. It's a mineral, and it comes from a deeper strata in the earth than any fossils would necessarily be. Now, I think that's maybe simplistic. I think that maybe there's components of organic material in there, but this is what I've heard from geologists, so I don't know. I feel like, you know, the entire thing was agreed upon by the Rockefellers many, many decades ago. Probably them plus the other banking families of how to create scarcity around one resource that everyone needs. So they picked oil, and they did it in the 1970s.
You know, the other thing is what people are really good at, you know. I know you mentioned a few jobs that were high prestige, brain surgeon or something, and these really high prestige jobs, you know, very few little kids or whatever go, I'm going to be a brain surgeon when I grow up, you know, or some kind of astronomical thing, you know, like I'm going to be a this or that. And instead of saying, what are they really good at and what do they really like to do, you know, so we're gonna be faced with that, too, with people and their trades, you know, what it is that they will trade.
And, I agree.
I
agree with
you. Know.
I think that also has to go, and it goes back to, you know, like you said, like we're all talking about here, it's not only education and value that is taught or not taught, and it goes back to, you know, it goes back to the soul. Like, what do you really enjoy to do? You know, what's your thing? You know, and what your thing may not be my thing or her thing or his thing. You know, and that brings the question is, you know, is that valuable to you?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
You see each person's gift as a value. And I
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, some guy over here and some lady over here, you know, can be extraordinary at something that I can't even fathom how they do it.
Yeah, it's all part of the puzzle, you know.
Yeah,
that how a community
part
works.
Of the puzzle, yeah. I love it.
But they'll all have a chance to do it if, you know, like say that we're each working 2 hours a day just to make the society work, whether it's something we really like to do or not. So what? It's 2 hours a day. We have the rest of the whole time to spend doing what we love, whether we're painting pictures, whether we're just walking, gardening, whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that makes a big difference because there is no reason. If you're not working for the man to get rich off of your labor, if you're working just not for profit, you know, it makes such a big difference. And there,
right.
Like the spirituality that Angel talks about, I mean, this is going to rise. We know we're all working on vibrations now, and the vibrations of the
yeah.
planet are rising. That will really increase the vibrations, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the concept of nurturing each other, being you know, closer to your neighbors, and
mm-hmm.
that is so hard. At least in the United States, everybody has like this, you know, kind of rugged individualist, so I can take care of my own type of attitude. But we're all relying on the same resources. So if we could take care of each other a little more and nurture each other's spirit, going back
yes.
to what Angel said, it would be such a much more healthy atmosphere. Everyone could just coexist and, like, not compete or think of themselves as better just because they have a PhD. But, you know, all of us are human beings. We all have the same basic needs.
Yes.
That's right.
You know, one thing that sparked, I got a roommate, some of you know, some don't. He's an artist, professional artist, and made a conscious choice to take his life down to a level where he could just do that. And I made a conscious choice to help support it. And one of the things when you're in the, we'll call it the village atmosphere, which is what we're talking about trying to get back to, where the community supports itself, the commodity of art has to go away. Art has to be just expression, not something for sale. We all probably have, I know I'm an artist, and I have tons of friends, musicians, whatever. I think everyone here is either an artist or a musician of some sort or both. And we all know this because we've all attempted to make a living at it, and the key dilemma with making a living expressing yourself is that it zaps that real hardcore tap into the creative vein when you really tap your consciousness and put something out. And I think part of maybe the erasure of society or the entrapment of it or culture, the erasure of culture we'll say, is the fact that we turned art into a commodity. That we've created pop music, that we've created the arts community where you sell and buy art, and it's now a traded item like the dollar, like oil, like everything else. And something I've been finding was I'm starting to pursue taking my life down to a simpler level, like what Ruthann said about getting more time to do this, and I don't want to sell it. I don't want to put it out there for anyone but to share, and I want to give it away if I feel like it, or just swap it in my yard if I make a sculpture. I want to make music just so for me to listen to and share with friends. I don't want to pursue it at a job level anymore because everyone I see doing it, it's they lost their heart to pay their mortgage, or they got smart, pulled their head out of their ass, and moved into the mountains, or did you know what my roommate did and rig up a deal where he could live cheap for a while, you know.
That's called hearing the pop.
Yeah, you know, but then we got like in, let's say, you know, some eco-villages. I know a guy down at the farm in Tennessee with Ina May. He's one of a builder down there, and we've talked a lot, and he was complaining about the fact that they always end up with some guitarist or something that feels that's his contribution to the community. Everyone else is weaving baskets, planting seeds, harvesting, and he feels that's his effort. And I blame modern culture for putting that in him. And I've been a professional musician and illustrator and writer, and I walked off all of them on the money level because it just, there was no heart in it anymore, and I didn't want to be a part of it. But, you know, that was my choice. But what about everyone else who's trapped in there, for instance, you know, the professional musician, when the dollar crashes, what is that guy going to do, you know, to feed his family if they don't get back to the core basic things Brett brought up? How do you keep warm in December? How do you feed yourself when you can't run to the 7-Eleven and buy your bag of chips and whatever the food desert offers, you know? Like, what do you do? And it's scary. Remember when New York crashed? They lost power for like 3 days. I think it was last year. Am I right? People died from that? I know there was a point where people were throwing the shit from their toilets into the street because they couldn't flush them anymore. And they were going like 20, 30 miles just to buy bottled water because the electricity went off and they could not pump water to the high-rises and all the homes in the center of that city. That was 3 days. They were just about ready to collapse over 3 days with no power.
Yeah.
You know, we are not ready.
Yeah.
No, everybody has to have, like, their own source of power because, like, the energy, like, free energy devices are going to be the key because when people can generate their own power, then they can, get, you know, system folks in ways that are unimaginable because now that whatever currencies or trades they're doing are liberated from the fact that they have to keep stuff running at home. And, like, the what you're talking about, like, with regard to art, I agree and I disagree because the thing is, everything you do can turn into an art form.
Nice.
You know, you can dedicate your life to something and it can become your passion and your art. And that is a contribution. In a free and open society, everyone who is living and doing the things that they want is contributing their own art. On the other hand, you have concept of, you know, where's the shit going to go? Who's going to want to do that? Like, it's a tough catch-22 there because we're now built up in a really specialized society where everyone does very niche type work. And not
That's
always what they want to be doing at all. So
and people are afraid to be generalists, you know?
Yeah.
To be a person with many hats, with many skills. And to provision, another like word thing I've been trying to replace is income, the word income versus the word provision or the word budget and provision. Thinking of provision as separate from money so that you start to think, oh, how do I provision myself in my power situation, in my, you know, basic systems and look at every which way you can do it without money first. I'm kind of the age I remember all the people from the Depression era talking about how they got through. And a lot of it had to do with they still had an infrastructure from before everything was monetized and everything was specialized. So they could go back to that. So everyone had a garden in the Warriors. They all had a victory garden. Like you said, we don't even have the infrastructure now to revert back in many cases. And I don't know. I would hate to say I think that a crisis would be the way to get us to go back to that because that's usually there's so much attrition in that I'm not sure how many lessons learned. A lot of people just learn how to steal stuff from other people, so that's not helpful. But
no.
If we have the option to gently transition, one thing is to get people's values to look at the fact that what sustainability is and what permaculture is enough to say that's going to be my highest value because that's something I can count on when these other things fail.
That's
but
right.
Unfortunately, it usually takes catastrophic failure to get our attention as human beings. But yeah, I don't know. That was the thing. People had a trade, they had a skill. People know how to do the home arts, you know, of how to cook instead of out of a box. Like, how would you cook something without a box? You know, how would you cook things without a microwave? You know, how would you? There's skill sets that are being lost. Right
I do both of those.
Yeah, good for you. How to sew something, you know, how to sew a garment, for God's sakes, or just even pick up a needle and thread and hem your pants, you know. These are lost skills, and again, you know, just the way we have our system set up, it's pretty much set up to fail because it's only built on growth. It's only built on capital being poured in. The capital has been pulled back. That's since 2008. That's why we have the situation that we have. You know, and some people are adapting, and many other people are just, you know, waiting for it to be over or just, you know, getting by however they can, but they're not making changes.
Yeah, I agree. I agree to a certain degree there, and I believe that just basic responsibility for life skills, for life, you know, that goes a long way. You know, knowing how to be responsible for oneself is not something that is learned through the school system. It's learned at home. Or it's not. And, you know, it becomes the response. You know, it goes back to my previous point. You know, I think a lot of people are not going to make it. You know, I'm sorry to say that, but I truly believe that. I don't think that billions and billions of people can make a switcheroo on you know, the precipice of the end. It's not realistic and practical. I think that what it's going to take is that those people that have these skills and are in touch with their consciousness and their soul and their mind and their body and understand the importance, I think it becomes then a duty to pass that knowledge on to as many people as you can. And sometimes it's passed on better when, you know, groups that understand the importance of these skills get together and just share each other's knowledge, which, you know, goes to open sourcing information, you know, where, oh, not coveting your information and knowledge and wisdom that you may harbor inside, but, and that also goes to education at home, because, you know, if you're taught to share and talk the value of life, you know, you'll share that information with people that don't know it, that want to know it. And I think, you know, really the key line I see here completely is how are we going to educate each other as adults, as adolescents? How are we going to educate our children and our grandchildren and on and on? How do we start educating them as best as we can with the smallest of groups that are out here coming together, you know, and get that information out to them and say, hey, we don't want to monopolize this. From sewing a button on your shirt all the way to, you know, it's not right to hit each other. It's not right to steal from one another. I mean, every little thing that you can imagine that could be important to getting along with each other and our neighbors and our family members. I mean, look at the amount of dysfunction that we have, you know, within family and friends and just society as general, because they are family and friends. So where does it start? You know, for me, it starts at home. You know, and, you know, it hit me a while back. You know, I thought to myself, wow, here are, you know, 9 to going on 10 billion people in this planet or so, and, you know, some people have this basic fundamental knowledge of responsibility for life, you know, not necessarily for society or for the system or for an educational process in the system, but literally life. You know, where's the value for that anymore? You know, permaculture and learning how to do your own victory gardens, that's taking responsibility for life. Not just yours either, but for the biological domain of Earth, and from the microclimate all the way up to the agroforestry to the permaculture swales and damming that could be utilized to feed the people. And, you know, I think that it starts with oneself and how we utilize our individual talents or gifts, how we see sharing of those gifts and knowledge, and, you know, how we come together with those of like minds to increase that sharing. Because the only way people are going to do it is the sharing of information and knowledge, you know, and learning a different way of going about educating themselves as well as the people, how they talk with one another, you know, whether it be a mom or dad you're talking to, or a son or daughter, or an aunt or uncle. It's the social fabric of consciousness that's lacking that. You know, growing food should be everyone's responsibility. You know, whether that drinking water that's contaminated, you know, it's fine and dandy. We all want to grow gardens and stuff like that. But you know what? On the realistic, practical, you know, avenue, we really don't have that much water anymore. And we've got people playing around with the environment way too much. You know, so there's a lack of that responsibility, and they learn that from home. It starts at home. I mean, when you're born into your family, whatever that family may be, you know, but they're your first teachers of the environment you're around and how to survive. You know,
right.
And
that,
the neurological implications, you know, are staggering with regards to that.
That's the example that Ken was bringing forth of this guy who thought his guitar was like his currency. Well,
yeah.
I mean, the guitar is not feeding you, man. Somebody had to cook
yeah.
that meal. Somebody had to dig that stuff out of the ground. So, I mean, if it comes down to like the training you were talking about, having growing up in families, sometimes people don't have that, and like they have to like learn to be in family and co-creation with others and with the earth. It's a learning curve. So like it again goes back to the education. People have to be uneducated of all of these false and dysfunctional paradigms in their relationship with others,
yeah.
interpersonal relationships, and then relationships that they think that they have with the planet, which are mostly non-existent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they got to be deprogrammed, definitely. I wouldn't say uneducated. I would say, well, that's a good way of saying it, actually. But I
yeah,
would say deprogrammed. Yeah, it is.
Debunk the entire thing. Throw it all out. Like 9 to 5 schooling or 8 to 4 or whatever it is, throw it out the
yeah.
window because these kids need to learn. Go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say one thing that might help is to figure out some way to get people off the couch watching TV because
yeah.
I think one of the major downfalls in this country, particularly. People watch TV, they see these commercials, been dumbed down enough to believe them. It's like, oh, if I just work another job. So, you know, a two-adult family is working 3 or 4 jobs to buy things that they don't have time to use. You know, but they have to do it because the guy next door has these things. So I think we've lost a lot of the whole spirituality. I think we're spiritually bankrupt as a country. And
yep.
that, and I'm generalizing, of course, but
yeah.
I think that somehow this has got to be put back in, all of us, not just the kids coming up, but the adults too. And I'm
yeah.
not quite sure how to do that. I mean, we know education is one thing, but I don't know how to go about that, really. I would say, though, not just your own kids at home, but your neighbor kids, whoever you come in contact with, you know.
Yeah.
Just try, whether it's the kids or the adults, try to impart a little bit of maybe your knowledge, and then you'll get something back for sure because, you know, this is the whole thing. I know this and you know that, so let's switch off here. And with kids,
right.
kids want to learn. They really do. So, you know, if you're doing a garden and your neighbor kids are hanging out, give them a hoe.
Yeah.
You know, seriously. I mean, and well, most kids like the idea that they can actually grow something when they see it coming up and then they know that they're going to eat something they grew. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a few that don't like the dirt, okay, you know. But, I mean, there's things like that if you get them involved. But
right.
I think adults are that way, too. If you find ways to involve them.
I know that a lot of public school systems are starting to approach it, and I would be impressed if any of us right now in the conversation are supportive of the standard public school system in America right now, but there is within there an attempt at this, and so, like, going down the vein of getting to the heads of children, because you're, like, you know, that old saying where, you know, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I'm not saying I believe it or don't. Many people change when they're knee-deep in the puddle, but when kids are young, if you normalize basic subjects, like, for instance, what Karen brought up, which just baffles me that is such an unknown thing, is knowing how to sew. Holy
yeah.
shit, I'm part of my French, but, you know,
yeah.
I don't make fun of for knowing how to sew. And you know what's funny is I don't know anyone around me that knows how to sew. And I only learned because in the 80s it was cool to peg your pants, and I kept poking myself with safety pins. So I sewed my damn pants up. And the next thing you know, I'm like, okay, I know how to sew. I mean, it doesn't look good, but I'm not at a loss. And it's sad, though, that is so gone. The simple things, you know, how to use a frying pan, how to, you know, make a cup of tea without using the microwave. Like, it just...
Oh, yeah.
Hey, how to light a fire, you know? My 6-year-old's learning how to light a fire right now. I'm a little nervous because he's looking at the pine forest right now for tinder, and I'm thinking, oh, God. But, you know, he's learning how to light a fire. And that was his interest, and it's around him because, you know, I hang out with weirdos who light fires and grow their own food. But that's not normal for an inner-city kid. And it's not normal for an urban or a suburban kid, for that matter, let alone, you know, it's really anyone that's in the rural environment might see it. But it's just that's not talked about in school, not expressed as important. And,
depends on
you know,
the school.
Well, yeah, there are some. Good point.
I was working out in Philly with a, you know, really progressive schools, and you wouldn't believe how these urban kids eat up the experience of, you know, being able to be in nature because it's something that they don't get to do every day. And, like, you show them how to do a skill out there, like pull an invasive weed. They're, like, on it. They know exactly what it looks like. And, you know, they're out there doing something for positive, and they feel it. They feel the generative force of contributionism rather than just, you know, learning something in a book.
I concur. I'm from Philadelphia. And, you know, I totally agree. I've seen that in Philadelphia. In fact, you know, when I was 8 and 9 years old, I was cooking dinner for the family. You know, and I was a latchkey kid, you know, and I would come home. My mom worked. My dad worked. I was home alone and with my sister, and she's younger. And it was my duty to make sure that I took, you know, what was defrosted in the refrigerator to the table and prep it the correct way and then put it in the oven and make sure it was getting cooked. You know, and in my family, it's very common to learn how to take care of oneself, even for a man or a boy to learn how to sew. You know, I had to learn. You know, my grandfather, my mom's dad, he could do anything. He could cut hair. He can redo your shoe soles for you. He worked on the roads and the highways doing construction. You know, I was 1 year old, you know, and he's taking me to houses to renovate. You know, and yeah, he was great. I mean, I'm where I'm at today because of those experiences.
Yeah.
Not because I went to school and learn something out of a textbook, which half the time, well, if we're talking about history specifically, you know, is so twisted and, you know, malnurtured throughout time and space, you know, that, you know, you don't know what to believe anymore.
Yeah,
and,
I'm relearning history. It's exciting. I'm learning true history now, which has nothing to do with what I learned in school, but I digress.
I hear you, girl. I mean, you know, that's the way it is. You know, you learn it later on, like, wait a minute, that was a lie. You know, and then you're like, what's the truth then? You know, and then you go looking for the truth, and you get this inquisitive nature about you, and it's very healthy. You know, as long as you don't get too angry that you become, you know, this militant rebel or something. But, you know, it's, you
that's
know, and at first I almost got down that route, you know, to be honest with you. You know, I thought that the only way to change it was, you know, to go out and hunt people down that were responsible for this fabrication and just get rid of them. And, you know, I realized, you know, I was like, well, how does that help me? You know, and, you know, it's going to hurt me because they're going to come for me and then I can't do anything else in life. It was more important for me to stay on a better path and be responsible for the lessons I learned from my grandfather, my mom, you know, who taught me how to cook, who taught me how to wash my clothes as a child. It was nobody, you know, we washed our own clothes. Hey, you want clean clothes? Break it down, get into that washer machine. You know, and that's how I grew up. And it came from
you know, them growing up dirt poor and realizing that family and unity and helping in the household and learning how to do things wasn't something that was a degradation of you know, one's manhood or womanhood. You know, there was no such thing as that when it came to, oh, do you know how to sew? Do you know how to fix your shoes? You know, do you know how to cut hair for your family? Can you feed your family? You know, and that had nothing to do with gender. This whole mixing up of that kind of stuff was just kind of part of the problem, I believe. You know, and
I agree.
You know, yeah, I'm glad you do. I mean, I feel this in my heart so deeply. I don't know how else to say it. You know, it's like, I don't care if you're a man or a woman. If you know something I don't know how to do, and I need you, I want you here by my side. Please show me. You know, a little humble compassion goes a long way. You know, and that's important to me.
Yeah.
So what do we do with the elite? I mean, what do we do with these people who are holding all of the perceived wealth? You said you felt like going after them. Well, I mean, in a sense, we are. Just by taking our sovereignty back, we're going after them. We don't have to even worry about them necessarily. What we have to do is create conscious communities of sovereignty, and like, and on an individual level first, like your own conscious community and family. You know, build it from that level and then build outward, because that is a frequency shift of the time, the concept of time, and it's a frequency shift in the concept of how you relate to yourself on the daily basis. So like, everything you've been saying is all about sovereignty, and it's all about taking control over the value of your time.
That's right. And, you know, when I say going after them, I meant, you know, sniping somebody.
you know, I
agree with you totally. you know, I was at that point where, you know, it could have gotten physical for me, and I'm well trained. You know, to do something like that at this point in my life. And, you know, I would never do it unless my community or family was, you know, in jeopardy of losing lives over ridiculousness. Like, you're growing a victory garden. You own a victory garden, we're taking you to prison. And then, you know, storming in there with a SWAT team, you know, and I see that happening more and more in organic farms, for Christmas sake. I mean, what's going on here? You know, but...
Yeah.
I was seriously at the point where I had to make a conscious decision whether I was going to start a revolutionary war, and I'm not even kidding. You can laugh. You know, it's kind of funny looking back at it, but I was dead serious about it. And or stopping and saying, okay, wait a minute. I could do more if I'm not engaged in the violent acts that I want to carry out because of anger. And it goes back to the soul. And consciousness talking to me, saying, hey, yeah, buddy, you know, it's not really good if you do that. You know, if you're dead or in prison, you can't change anything. And, you know, maybe at some point in defense, you may have to be in that position, but I'm not in that position, and I wasn't.
Well, think about it this way. I mean, you were no different at that point than the armed militias out at the Bundy farm. Like, those people are in a stance that they don't need to share anything with anyone. They don't need to pay for their resources. And,
yeah.
And in a sense, like, it's kind of funny. Like, I agree with the concept of being able to take a local plot of land that is not, you know, titled and seed and taxed the hell out of, but take care of it as a custodian. This dude is completely the opposite of that on the polarity scale, because he's saying, this belongs to me. I don't care about anything. I don't care about the land. I'm just going to throw my cows on here. And, you know, screw the government, you know, even though they're probably paying, you know, benefits for some of my own relatives to live. You know, it's like this mismatch. Don't touch my Medicare, but the government's the problem. Like, it's just so weird. I don't really understand the Tea Party kind of
bylaw. I want to chime in here because
we have 75 seconds left.
Okay.
So.
the elite system is able to use energy in the negative and the positive in absolute value. So they're equally happy if you're against them because they can take that energy and turn it into more of them being relevant. That's all I wanted to say.
Right on. Right on.
Right on.
That's why it's about quality.
Right.
None of that matters.
Wow. I think that was effective.
We will be back next Monday night.
Next Monday night. I was trying to remember where we left off.
Hopefully we'll figure out how to do our Skype on our Linux boxes. We have a problem.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys, for putting this together.
Awesome.
Hopefully this
goes
well. Yeah, next week we'll take it back up.
Love you guys.
Love you, too.
Love you.
Bye.